We're looking today at Revelation 17 and 18, the woman on the beast. Now, in our last session, we were reading of the lead up to Armageddon, climaxing with the crushing of the world's armies. They will be gathered on the plain of Megiddo, north of Jerusalem, and Satan brings them together, but he's actually fulfilling God's plan. And there's no mention of any weapons of war or battle that actually goes on, but the armies who are against God are utterly destroyed, and it's Jesus that they confront. We'll see that in Revelation 19 later, and he simply has to speak. And Martin Luther in his hymn, one little word, that's all that's needed from the Lord to deal with his enemies. But prior to that climax, six judgments will have been poured out on an utterly corrupt world. You know, the painful sores, the terrible sun scorching, those things. But the seventh judgment is the actual end. And here in Revelation 17 and 18, a powerful angel gives the Apostle John, and they talk about it being in parentheses, like in brackets, more detail of the satanic system which will end when Christ appears and treads the winepress. But these things have been going on through these 7 years, particularly the last 3.5 years. And it's as though the angel says to John, you've seen the outline, here is more of the fuller story. So the focus is on two identities, the woman and the beast. So in the woman represents the world religious system. And we get most of that in Revelation 17, although it mixes up a bit. This world religious system at the end will be energized by the false prophet, but is judged. And then the beast, and we see more of that in Revelation 18, is the world political and economic system under the Antichrist, and that system is judged. But together, the religious and the political make up Babylon the Great. And the woman is riding the beast. From Babel onward, religious and political systems have always used each other. Power, wealth, influence, all intertwined there. And the world's false religious system is called the great prostitute, the harlot. Supposedly, you see, it's a worship of God, but it is not. It's worship of idols, and it's, in our day and age, it's worship of man, of ourselves. But the false religious system, this prostitute, actually worships Satan. And by contrast, the true church is the pure bride of Christ. And we are going to see that in our next session. Well, chapter 17, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. That means on the nations across the world, those waters. With her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. So the religious power is in bed with the political rulers, and people get intoxicated by that mix. The power, the pomp, the promises that are supposedly there. And today, how many are actually intoxicated with militant Islam? So that you see these men who are drunk with the idea of the religion that they are following and the power and how they can wield it over the earth. So then the angel carried me away into a desert. So this religious harlot isn't life-giving but barren like a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. These seven heads are going to keep coming up, and we'll talk about that. They are the empires that ruled the world after Nimrod. So Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. They are all pagan. and all therefore blasphemous. The seventh one, revived Rome, is yet to come, and ten powers will support the Antichrist. Now, verse 4, the woman, the religious system, was dressed in purple and scarlet. And we see these are the colours of the Vatican, the cardinals and so on, but also all this glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls is also a description of the Kaaba stone in Mecca, with all of that, you know, so put them together, very, very rich. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. As we said, false religion began at Babel, it's Genesis 10, and with that rejection of God, there began that belief in mythical gods, the worship of idols. Satan is a great counterfeiter, isn't he? So people came to believe that Nimrod's wife, Semiramis, had a son called Tammuz, who was immaculately conceived. He was killed, and he came to life again. And so these fertility rites and a mother-son cultic worship began, and they connected it with spring, the earth coming to life following the winter. This all spread from Babylon to Egypt to Phoenicia to Greece to Rome, and the names of the goddess change from Ishtar in Arabia or Astarte and Baal. In Egypt, Isis and Osiris, in Greece, Aphrodite and Eros, in Rome, Venus and Cupid, just according to the location and the language. And so when the Roman Emperor Constantine, in the late 4th century AD, he opened the way for Christianity to become the state religion. It followed on after him. And you can see the church, which has been so persecuted all of this time and is persecution weary, is almost glad to put down the battle and to have the acceptance of the state, of the government, and be joined with it. But pagan festivals became Christian holy days. So you know we have Easter. Now that's from Ishtar or Astarte. And we have Easter eggs and Easter bunnies, the rabbits with their prolific reproduction. We probably here don't ever burn the Yule log, which is the child that's burned and then is resurrected as the Christmas tree brilliantly decorated after the burning. All these things. But perhaps the most tragic thing was the worship of the pagan goddess called the Queen of Heaven. And I mean, this was from the beginning. I mean, Judah, Jerusalem, a good bit of why they were exiled to Babylon was they could go right there and see what it was like, I guess. But they began to worship the Queen of Heaven. Jeremiah 7:18, Jeremiah says, "The children gather wood, the fathers light the bread, and the women knead the dough and make cakes of bread for the Queen of Heaven." And the Lord told those Jews living down in Egypt, I paraphrase this here, go ahead and worship the Queen of Heaven, burn incense to her, but I tell you, if you do, you will perish by famine or sword. Now that's Jeremiah 46:17. And in the church, that same thing began to happen, and the Virgin Mary became the Queen of Heaven. And she has come to be called the Mother of God. I note that in the Gospels, Jesus does not call Mary Mother once. He calls her woman, a very dignified title. But Mary was the obedient and humble servant of God who was willing for God to use her humanity in order to bring his son into the world as a man. But Mary was a sinner, as all born of Adam are sinners, and Jesus is her saviour, just the same as he is ours. But the church, with its false shepherds that rose up, those false shepherds who were intoxicated with power, began to place Mary above Jesus Christ. So she, even today, is the one prayed to because she answers prayer. She is able to forgive sins. She heals diseases. She gets people out of purgatory. Well, purgatory is a pagan belief. It's not a Christian. It's not in the Bible at all. And in nearly all the graven images, and we're not supposed to have graven images, and the pictorial images of Mary and Jesus together, Jesus always remains the child. Mary is the adult. And there are shrines to Mary all over the world. And it seems miracles do happen, but they are occultic. Now, there was like one church until the Reformation in the 15th century, as it was called. We talk about the Catholic Church. Catholic actually means universal. So it was the universal church. And the Eastern Orthodox Church was included in that. And those are the two legs of Rome. Remember that statue Nebuchadnezzar had the dream of? And you've got the Western leg and the Eastern leg. Well, I think we're kind of getting to the point where we talk about the 10 horns, the 10 powers. They've got 10 toes, but you've got East and West. And these two systems eventually split under different authorities, the final split in 1054 AD. The Western leg under the popes, the Eastern leg under the patriarchs. Now both pope and patriarch mean father. Now will the Eastern and Western legs unite? Yes, there is so much work already being done to bring the Orthodox and the Catholic together. But the Pope or Father has supreme authority. He is called the Vicar of Christ. Now that means that he is in the place of Christ, like he represents Christ. But it literally means in the place of, and he has taken the place of Christ in many ways. So what he decrees then has more authority than Scripture. And for centuries, the ordinary laity, if you weren't a monk or in one of the priests, you weren't allowed to read the scriptures on pain of death. And what the Pope says is infallible. You can't argue with it. And he has the power to send people to heaven or hell because he has the keys of Peter. And I haven't got time to go into all of that. But, you know, Peter was told he could bind and loose. Well, he opened the door to those in Jerusalem and then to Samaria and then to the Gentiles. That promise too was given to the other disciples as well, but this is what has happened. Now I was with some BSFers in San Antonio and we were in a taxi and we were going to Max Lucado's church to suss it out because, you know, it's quite famous. And the taxi driver listening to us, he got quite interested and got into the conversation. He said that he was Italian and he had been brought up as a Catholic, but he had a Protestant friend who got him interested in the Bible. And once he got into it, he had to keep going. And then he found Matthew 23:9, where Jesus says, "Do not call any man on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven." Now, he's not talking about biological dads. He's talking about the authority figure of father. And so that really hit me, the taxi driver said. He said, "I'd been accepting the authority of the Pope over God, because the Pope tells you what is right and what's wrong." And then he said, "I go to a different church these days." And we know from history that those fathers, because of the power they had, became drunk and they killed untold thousands who opposed them. So the Spanish Inquisitions, they killed more heretics than all of the Roman emperors put together. So a heretic being anyone who will not accept what the church, the Pope, has to say. And so I'm not trying to badmouth people who go to the Catholic Church. In fact, right through the ages, God has always had his people there. Those who actually belong to him. But much of the teaching has been prostituted. So I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. And false religion is a cruel, sadistic system. Of course it is, because it's Satan's system. And tragically, it entered the church, into the Protestants as well. So that after the Reformation, you still had Protestants then burning Catholics. Or you know the whole, if you know anything about Henry VIII and Bloody Mary and Queen, all of that historic stuff of church and state, that's the problem. The church and state together get into bed together and it doesn't stay pure that way. So, I mean, there are many divisions then among Protestants. The nonconformists then were in trouble, persecuted. That's why the Pilgrim Fathers fled to America. And with these divisions, Jesus prayed. There's no visible unity in the church, but Jesus prayed that we would all be one. And with those who really belong to Jesus, we are one. We know. Isn't there a heart connection with people who belong? And I do thank God for the great missionary work that went on through the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries so much. But even today amongst evangelicals, the church has become Laodicean in so many ways, lukewarm and increasingly apostate. So verse 6b, when John saw the harlot religious system, he said, I was greatly astonished. And many are astonished when they know something about church history and what has gone on. But Jesus forewarned exactly how it would be in those parables of Matthew 13. He said that the kingdom of God, if we put the church being God's people, was like a wheat field, and Satan came and sowed all these tares, weeds, in amongst the true wheat. And he said it was like this mustard plant that's supposed to actually be a fairly small plant, but grew into an abnormally large tree, so the birds came and roosted in it. Now, birds are agents of Satan. Jesus, in fact, had just told a parable about how the seed is sown, the birds come and snatch it away, and he said, that's the devil taking the word away before it can take root. And in other places, birds represent Satan's agent. And he said it's like the yeast or the leaven that a woman took, it always represents sin, took and mixed with the three measures of meal until a whole dough was leavened. And I think it's Misler who says that leaven is a corrupting agent that works by puffing up. And I think that's a good illustration. But then the angel said to me, so we know the church will be infiltrated. But then the angel said to me, why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has seven heads and ten horns. There's these seven powers again. The beast which you saw, and there seems to be more concentration on the political economic side of Babylon. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. Now, the inhabitants of the earth, whose names who have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. And of course, those who are not believers, whose names are not in the book of life, are going to be astonished when this beast, this revived Roman Empire, that is so bad that when Daniel saw a vision of it, he was sick for 3 weeks. That's how bad it will be. And you see, it's the beast, there's the Roman Empire, which once was, then disappeared, but will in the end time reappear as the revived Roman Empire, you know, with its two legs and 10 toes. So the empire then is also personified in the Antichrist, that dictator, the man of sin, who will receive a head wound, will appear to die, but is revived. And when he first comes on the scene, it says that he comes out of the sea, out of the nations. But after his apparent death, it says he comes out of the abyss, because Satan has possessed him utterly at that time, and it seems like probably possessed also the whole of the system in a way we haven't yet seen. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. Now, in John's day, Rome ruled, and the city of Rome sits on seven hills. But these hills also may represent the empires that came after Babel that I've mentioned. There, so it goes on, there are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come, but when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. Yes, you're right there. These are the seven kingdoms. Five have fallen. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece. One is, that's Rome in John's day, because this is when John's writing it. And one is still to come, the revived Rome, and that is the seventh. And out of that whole system, the Antichrist will be the little horn that comes up like the eighth king. So the ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. Now, there are those who see this as the European Union. There are those who see it that there are five on the left and five on the west and five on the east, and work it out in different kinds of ways, but they certainly give their support to the world dictator. Verse 14, they will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen and faithful followers. And when we get to Revelation 19, we find that the saints come with him, we come with him. Then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. This is the waters. So we know that we are moving toward, quite swiftly, towards a global world religion as well as a global political system. You know, they're talking about a one world order, a new world order, but a one world religion. We have already established the Council for World Religion and Peace, and leaders from every faith belong to it. Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, everything that you can think of belong. Now, Protestants have their World Council of Churches, where the Protestant churches have come together. But what is meant in that coming together is having to not be too fundamental. Fundamental means you know the fundamentals of your faith, and become very tolerant and politically correct, and therefore very liberal in your views about that. So they tend to be going more for human rights than the real worship of God. And in 1997, ECT was formed. Evangelicals and Catholics together, that's the ECT. And a lot, so that's a really good thing, unity there. But one evangelical said the Reformation has been undone. If we come together and say, well, what you believe is perfectly okay and what you teach is perfect, you know, it doesn't matter one way or the other, there is a real problem. But the Antichrist will know how to bring this all together, with his seven-year peace plan, with the covenant that he makes with many. Israel is a big part of that. Will even Islam and Christianity come together? Well, have a look at David Hunt's book, The Woman Rides the Beast, and see how the worship of Mary has infiltrated Islam and that sort of thing. But 2 years ago, a new centre for interreligious dialogue and tolerance was opened in Vienna, and it is funded by Saudi Arabia. And, I mean, Saudi Arabia has this extreme version of Islam, Wahhabism. And if anybody becomes a Christian, well, they're just going to be killed. That's the bottom line. But the opening was attended by the United Nations Secretary Ban Ki-moon. He made an address, lent his support, and the Secretary General of OIC, that's the Organisation of Islamic Cooperation. And you know what? The speaker from that represents some 57 Muslim states, groups, called on the Western government to implement legislation against Islamophobia. And one wonders about the Judeo-Christian phobia rampant in the Islamic countries, but the Antichrist will know how to bring these things together. And of course there are people across Europe and Britain who fear that those areas are being Islamised. Now, in a former study, we saw that the European Union parliamentary building in France is a model built on Hegel's painting of the Tower of Babel. I didn't bring the photos, but it's, you know, circular, and it's got scaffolding at the top. They haven't finished it because in the Tower of Babel, God came down, confused the language, they couldn't finish it. They've got it like that. And out the front is the statue of a woman riding the beast. It harkens back to the pagan legend where Zeus, who's the chief of gods, was enamoured by the woman Europa. And so he became a bull, he turned himself into a bull, and he enticed her to ride on his back. But then in the end he turned and raped her. And I think, don't the people choosing these symbols connect the dots? She's Europa and she's raped. And that's sort of the end. Is that what they want for Europe? But you know, Satan is such a deceiver, isn't he? People don't even put the picture together. So it's unclear, of course, in many details, and I certainly don't have them all. And Satan is extremely crafty, but we do know that the world religious prostitute will ride on the back of the world system, the Antichrist, until Antichrist, he wants to be God himself, turns on her. He's going to set up this image of himself in the temple in Jerusalem. So he's brought all faiths together into this global religion, and Judaism will be, of course, included in that seven-year covenant. It's got a lot to do with them. And you might have seen videos where prophecy buffs say that the temple in Jerusalem will be built on the Temple Mount. The Dome of the Rock is there now, and they're saying you don't actually have to remove the Dome of the Rock, because where the original temple was, you can put it alongside and it's still in its right place. And they see, a lot of people see, that the two of them, the Dome of the Rock and the temple, will be there together. But we know that midway through the seven-year tribulation, the Antichrist sets up an image of himself in that temple, commanding all people to worship him, and that it says in Daniel 9:27, on the wing of the temple will be the abomination that causes desolation. Well, people who've put the video together, you know, they do these moving things, actually show, they don't show the image of the beast inside, but on the pinnacle of the temple, a crescent moon. Now, I don't know if that's how it's going to be, but you know, that's what some people are speculating. We do know that when whatever it is happens, the Jews are told to flee. Jesus said that. Now, there are some, like Waleed Shubat, he was a Muslim who's become a Christian, believes that the religious base will be in Mecca, in Arabia, and they point to Isaiah 21 for that. But there are three cities mentioned most in the Bible. First Jerusalem, then Babylon, then Rome. Now David Jeremiah puts it this way, that during the tribulation period, he says, Rome will be the political base. So it may not actually be in the city of Rome, it could be European Union or headquarters or whatever, but will be in the Rome political. Babylon, and he sees that as being Babylon re-established, and that down there on the Red Sea will be this huge port and commercial base. That will be the commercial base, and Jerusalem will be the religious base. So, if we go on, it says, this is all going to happen because God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. So chapter 17, we've had more of a look at ecclesiastical Babylon. Chapter 18, more of political commercial Babylon. But remember, it's together under the system of Satan, the prince of this world, they are called Babylon the Great. So in 18 of 17, the woman you saw is the great city, this great system that rules over the kings of the earth, but her doom is sure. After this, chapter 18, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his splendor. With a mighty voice he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons, a haunt for every evil spirit and every detestable bird," because that's what they represent. "For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." So Satan has conspired with men, and the world is in bed with the corruption and exploitation of Babylon's system, which is Satan's system. Mm. "Then I heard another voice from heaven say, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins.'" It's so easy to be caught up, isn't it, in the materialistic world and the messages all around. But we don't want to be caught up in her sins, and we don't want to be receive those plagues that will be sent upon her. It says her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. And he says, "Give back to her as she's given, give her back double. Give her as much torture and grief and as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart she boasts, 'I sit as a queen, I'm not a widow, I'll never mourn.'" Verse 8, "Therefore in one day plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, famine. She'll be consumed by fire." That's the last thing. "For mighty is the Lord God who judges her." And it says in one day, and will that be nuclear, perhaps? I think, will Iran actually, or will that be a totally different thing? "Well, when the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her." So somehow the world system has been destroyed. Does it mean that our technology has been brought to an end? Our computer systems, our communication systems have all crashed. Now, it's Chuck Misler who talks a lot about, because he's a guy who came through the Naval Academy in the US and got a lot of knowledge there. An EMP could do this. That is an electric magnetic pulse. He says this is a nuclear device that if, say, a ship 15 miles offshore fired into the air high above a nation and detonated it, it would wipe out every electrical and every communication thing of half the size, one would do half the size of America. Or you can imagine if everything, it wouldn't just be your fridge and the petrol pumps that don't work. There's no finance records, there's no nothing anymore, right across the corporate world and the personal home world. So, terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, "Woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power, in one hour your doom has come. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore." This will be worse than any global financial crisis we've seen. Now, it gives a whole list of things that fall, and this is verse 12, talks about gold, silver, articles of, I've put down my version, the banking industry, mining, clothing, textile, fashion, building, manufacturing, household products, the food industry, agriculture, cattle, sheep, vehicles of every kind, air, sea, shipping and freight industry gone, and bodies and souls of men. Now, bodies and souls of men have been enslaved to this system, and you know how it is, that we're caught in this. We can't really look after ourselves anymore. The system has ensured we are dependent. We can be told what to do, but employment is gone. So verse 14, those kings involved who are in power, they lament And verse 15, the merchants lament. Oh woe, oh woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, with gold and stones and pearls. In 1 hour such great wealth has been brought to ruin. And then the sailors and so on, captains, that's the shipping and freight companies. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, was there ever a city like this great city? Woe, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she has been brought to ruin. But heaven rejoices, for wickedness is at last being brought to an end, and the shocking persecution of God's people is finished. So rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets, for God has judged her for the way she has treated you. And then a mighty angel picks up a millstone, or boulder like a millstone, and throws it into the sea. He says, with that violence, Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. So, in that system, or if it's Babylon rebuilt, even if it's down by the further down the Euphrates, there'll be no music, no tradesmen, no manufacturing, no business. It'll be dark. There'll be no weddings, no celebrations ever again. And it says, your merchants were the world's great men, aren't they? The multinationals, and so on. Your magic, by your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. So will the actual city of Babylon be rebuilt? Will it be with a great port down on the Persian Gulf? Some think it's a strong possibility. And in Zechariah 5, I'll just give you this for your interest, there is a strange prophecy. An angel shows Zechariah a vision of a woman in a basket. Then the angel who was speaking to me came forward and said, look up and see what this is that is appearing. I asked, what is it? He replied, it's a measuring basket. And he added, this is the iniquity of the people throughout the land. Then the cover of lead was raised, and there in the basket sat a woman. He said, this is wickedness. And he pushed her back into the basket and pushed the lead cover down over its mouth. Then I looked up, and there before me were two women with the wind in their wings. They had wings like those of a stork. Stork is an unclean bird in Israel, and they lifted up the basket between heaven and earth. Where are they taking the basket? I asked the angel who was speaking to me. He replied, to the country of Babylonia, to build a house for it. When it is ready, the basket will be set there in its place. So I leave that with you to ponder that one. Wherever it proves to be, great Babylon will fall. For in her was found the blood of prophets and of the saints and all who have been killed on earth. Now, that is a very difficult session, isn't it? It's been a long one for you, very sobering. But the people of God, I believe, are being made ready for what is to come. And we have a world where Israel is in the land. We have a globalised, a technological world such hasn't been before. And I'm very interested in what Edward Gibbon wrote in 1788. And he's the man who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. This is the first one. And he gives five reasons why that great civilization withered and died. One, the undermining of the dignity and sanctity of the home as a basis for human society. Second, higher and higher taxes. The spending of public money for free bread, you know, the welfare system that spends it well and wrongly, and circuses, entertainment for the populace. I tell you, we have a new cathedral in Adelaide, and it is called the Adelaide Oval. And three, the mad craze for pleasure, sports becoming every year more exciting, more brutal, more immoral. Four, the building of great armaments when the real enemy was within, the decay of individual responsibility. And five, the decay of religion, faith fading into a mere form, losing touch with life, losing power to guide the people. Now that's the first Rome. Surely the same thing is applying what we were seeing as we see Rome is going to be revived and the things are in place. Now we cannot halt those things and God is bringing it to a glorious conclusion. And if that's also depressing, then think what we are told. This is not our home. We are merely passing through. Our home is in heaven. And like Abraham, we are not fixed on this city of Babylon, but we are looking forward to the city whose architect, imagine what kind of, whose architect and builder is God. That is what is awaiting us. And as Nolene would say, this life here might seem pretty tough, but it's like a glitch on a computer screen compared to eternity, which goes on with our glory with the Lord forever and ever. So are there things we should be getting into line? Last thing, is there some little disobedience that you know you're not prepared to? I had to speak at Murray Bridge on Wednesday night and I told them about Stella and her teapot, because the question's put, what hinders you from really obeying the Lord? Now Stella had a heirloom teapot, been in the family. When her mother died, she took it even though her sister said, Mum promised it to me. Big bust up, family feud, didn't speak to one another, all of that. Stella was a Christian. You know, she couldn't get on with her Christian life in that kind of atmosphere. And she was confronted. She took that teapot round to her sister and gave it back. And then she could testify. Her life began to open up. Now with us, is there any little thing as like, well, I'll do everything, but there's one area where my conscience pricks me a bit, but I don't want to look at that one. So I just leave that with you. There may or may not be, but I know I have to do this. And if God seems slow in bringing in his kingdom, it's because he's not willing that any should perish. He's got more to bring in. So we've got our families to pray for. We've got so many to pray for. And we will leave it there for today. Thank you.